Fantastic benefits to starting this podcast, and I was kind of blown away by the whole thing myself, is meeting people like my guest today, Andrew Jasko. We met on the post-evangelical writers group that I started. He joined it probably sometime last year, and he's posted up some things, some articles he's written on his blog, which is lifeafterdogma.org, and he writes a lot of stuff about sexuality and religion, and in fact, this podcast today is timed to come out before his upcoming seminar, which is in Oakland, California on the 14th of August, and it is titled Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion. And in fact, this is one of the topics that Andrew and I get into in this episode today. There is a lot of stuff that we get into. We're going to get into his backstory coming out of evangelicalism and looking at some of these topics. We're going to talk about hell. We're going to talk about psychological, spiritual, sexual issues around religion, and particularly evangelical Christianity, which is, of course, Andrew's own story, where he comes out of. But of course, these issues are by no means confined to evangelical Christianity, because if you step back and look at this issue with a little bit of objectivity, you'll realize that really all religions historically have exhibited what I'm calling the title of this episode: fear, guilt, and shame, the holy trinity of religions, ways to control people through fear, through shame, through guilt, through authoritarianism, through patriarchy. And in fact, he even makes the point that even if you're not a religious person, you have been affected by religion in society. So it's all pervasive, really. And what I love about Andrew is his approach to religion, and particularly Christianity in general, is that he's not necessarily coming at it from the sort of classic intellectual arguments, you know, like issues over whether or not God exists, looking at issues with the Bible or whatever. He's coming at it from a purely psychological, existential point of view, saying, wait a minute, we need to look at the trauma, the damage, the emotional, the psychological, the sexual damage that religion has done to people. And on that level, there's some huge, major, massive issues that we have to look at. And his passion really is to help people who are damaged, who have been unbelievably hurt by religion, and again, in particular, by Christianity, by evangelical fundamentalist Christianity. And so this is what we're going to be talking about in this episode today. So I'm glad you've joined me. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, here on Mindshift Podcast. I'm going to be bringing you in a few minutes this conversation with Andrew Jasko, talking about the results of religion on him personally, his own backstory, and then we're going to get into a whole wide-ranging, one of the best conversations I've had around this topic, of the actual damage that it does to people. And what I love about Andrew is that he's very articulate, he's very well-spoken, and he has a way of just kind of cutting right to the chase, getting right into the issue and explaining exactly what the problems are. And it's made me realize, especially as talking to my sister Valerie, who's just joined me here on The Rock. She came in the other day. She flew in from Seattle, and we're about ready to go off to France for an epic World War I battlefield tour. In fact, even as this episode drops, we'll be probably somewhere down around Canterbury, down in England, about ready to board the ferry the next morning to head over to Calais and embark on our epic World War I tour of France and Belgium, some of the great battlefields of World War I. But one of the things I love about this episode is that it makes me realize, and this is something that Valerie and I are talking about as we've been visiting, the damage that it's done to us. We were both raised in fundamentalist Christianity. We were both affected in just so many ways, psychologically, in terms of sexuality, emotional trauma, and how it's affected us all the way through our adult lives, through our marriages, through our relationships with other people, the way we view God, the way we view others, the way we've been dealt with by the church and how we've left the church. So one of the things we're going to be doing while my sister Valerie is here too is we're going to be doing a follow-up to our podcast that we did last year when we talked about surviving a fundamentalist upbringing. So look for that coming out in the next few months as well. And I'm just going to say here real quick before I get into the conversation with Andrew that if you are interested in supporting Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, there's a really cool reward that I'm going to be starting up here pretty soon. I've been recording the pre-recording conversations with my guests, and we get into some stuff. We talk about issues that we're going to be talking about, and I get a little bit of stuff that is sort of off the record, as it were. And so I'm going to be putting those little conversations up on Patreon as a reward for supporters. So I have a really good one here with Andrew Jasko. So it's some kind of bonus content. I've also got a conversation that I had with Chris Stroop, which is going to be coming up in a few weeks as well. And that's a really good conversation that we get into. So if you want to hear those conversations as a kind of a bonus feature, you can support this show on Patreon, even for as little as a dollar a month, and gain access to that, as well as the secret private Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And you can be a member of that as well by supporting on Patreon. And all the links to that are in the show notes. All right. So without further ado, here we go. Let's get into this conversation with Andrew Jasko, as I am happy to bring you this episode today. Fear, Guilt, and Shame, The Holy Trinity of Religion with Andrew Jasko. I am super happy to be joined by Andrew Jasko. You are the host of the Life After Dogma blog. You're coming to us all the way from San Francisco. Do you want to say hi to everybody, Andrew?
Hello, everybody. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being on Mindshift Podcast. I know we've kind of been friends through the post-evangelical writers group. I think that's how we met, wasn't it? I remember seeing some of your posts about some of the blog articles that you'd written.
That's correct. I am definitely a former evangelical.
You are, yes, you're definitely a post-evangelical, ex-evangelical, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's going to be really interesting to get into your backstory, because you came out of evangelicalism, isn't that right? So what's your story? How did you get out, and, you know, where are you at now? We got to get into all those things. And then I think we're going to be touching as well on some of the stuff that you like to write about, some of your interests. And you've got a seminar coming up. I think we're going to have to put a plug in for that on the 14th of this month. So we want to hear what you're talking about there. But can you tell us your story? Where'd you come from, and evangelicalism and all that?
Great. So I was formerly an evangelical and Pentecostal Christian minister, and I spent my whole life in religion. Religion was my whole identity, my passion, my everything. My parents are Pentecostal Christian ministers. And Pentecostals believe in a very experiential form of Christianity. They're dedicated to world evangelism. There's about 500 to 600 million of them in the world today. And they're also evangelicals and fundamentalists. They believe in the Bible as the literal and inspired word of God. So I grew up as a Christian, dedicated to a life of service to God from a very young age. And it was really just my everything for most of my life, and I never imagined in a million years that I would ever leave Christianity, much less speak out about its abuses. But I went to the evangelical college called Wheaton College to study for a degree in Bible and ministry. During that time, I fell in love with the nation of India. I went on a missionary trip to India for a couple months, and I ended up going there 5 times. And decided to devote my life to evangelizing the nation by training indigenous ministers to plant churches in their various people groups or tribes in order to bring about the second coming of Jesus. We believe that every group, every distinct group of ethno-linguistic tribal people had to be reached with the church in their language, in their people group, in order for Jesus to come back. So I had a very strategic life purpose and mission that I dedicated myself to. And it was believed that being a missionary was kind of the highest purpose one could aspire to. That's what we were taught. So I was going all out. I kind of wanted to be this like Jason Bourne figure of evangelicalism. That's kind of how I imagined myself in a lot of ways. I went to Princeton Seminary to get my Master of Divinity degree because I really found my vocational identity in preaching and in teaching. And it was during that time that I had what people describe as a crisis of faith.
Ah, yes. And the old crisis of faith. Yep. We've all had it, I think, at some point or another.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Most of us, well, who have left, we had to have one. Sorry, go ahead.
And I was going to say, the question is whether or not you double down and stay in the evangelical system. I think that that's the crux for a lot of people, isn't it? That there are a lot of evangelicals today who have had a crisis of faith, but they went to somebody, they talked about their problems, and they got all their questions answered, and so they've stayed in. Whereas obviously you're saying you didn't stay in, you ended up getting out. So how did this crisis of faith end up leading to you deconstructing?
That's right. And part of the thing about evangelicalism and religion in general is that it has kind of a set of ready-made answers to a lot of the problems and questions that people have. And I think I often come across the question, well, how can intelligent people buy into religion? Because we know so much of it is invalidated by science or a lot of the major academic disciplines out there. And I think it's because these religious systems have kind of a logic of illogic and a way of keeping people in the system, both through these kind of ready-made intellectual answers and different psychological mechanisms. So for me, the reason that I left my religion was not primarily intellectual. It was psychological distress. I came to a point where I was incredibly unhealthy. I realized that I was just in a state of anxiety and guilt and depression, and I wanted to get healthy. I said to myself, I'm going to do whatever it takes in order to get healthy. And that means asking questions about my religion. I'm going to ask them, and I'm going to trust that God is going to keep me. So I guess that didn't end up working out quite the way I expected.
God didn't keep you.
But no, apparently not.
He's let you down, apparently.
Yeah, I guess so. But I'm grateful for that.
Grateful that God let you down. That's funny. Because I was going to say, I can remember when I was back in Bible college, I had a similar crisis of faith. I was actually teaching Bible study methods as a student, kind of in a lab instructor. And I went to this kind of mentor guy that I had, and I said to him, the problem is I don't think I'm buying what I'm selling. I don't believe it myself. And yet I'm trying to convince these people that it's all true. And he ended up talking me around and got me to stay back within the fold, you know? So I ended up going on like you and doing the master's degree, and I was a preacher and all the rest of it. So that crisis of faith for me didn't result in me getting out of the faith, at least not at that point. So you're in this process of deconstructing, but you're saying it wasn't primarily intellectual, which is interesting because here you're doing a master's degree. What was the psychology behind what was going on in your life?
Well, I like to call attention, Clint, to the psychological abuses in religion. And I think that a lot of attention has been called, and rightfully so, to the intellectual issues with dogmatic religions. But I think that there's just so much psychological oppression and abuse that goes on. So I like to approach religion from the perspective of mental health, because that's how I experienced a religion, and that's how I came out of it, because of its psychological abuses. So I had struggled for a very long time with anxiety, and I really didn't know why. But I began to see that a lot of the teachings I was receiving from the Bible were really at the root of my experience of anxiety. So in evangelicalism, we are taught that we are sinful. Our basic inclination is to do evil, and that we have to confess our sins to God. And for me, this kind of resulted in this obsessive compulsive type thinking. I imagine God was like a thought police in my head, because we were taught to search our souls constantly for any impure or sinful thought and to be right with God. And so this kind of resulted in something of an anxiety disorder. And there was always this threat of divine judgment really at the root of the faith, because of a belief in a literal hell. So we were never really certain about our salvation, or I was never really certain about my salvation. It was always a question of whether I was truly right with God. And, well, was I elect? Was I one of God's chosen in eternity? Or would I end up never being saved to begin with because I wasn't elect? Or if it was a matter of free will, was I right with God? And I was taught that I could lose my salvation if I fell into sin and didn't confess. So I was always searching, And there was a lot of anxiety in the system. There was just a lot of fear. There was a lot of shame. There was a lot of guilt. And so I ended up realizing, just the more I learned about psychology and mental health, that there were a lot of things and teachings in fundamentalism that looked like mental disorders in a lot of ways. There are a lot of parallels with post-traumatic stress syndrome and with issues of shame and with anxiety and depression. And a lot of this made sense when I looked at some of the teachings that were in the Bible.
I was going to say, the interesting thing about what you're talking about is, I mean, I went through the same kind of thing growing up in a fundamentalist church. I was just sharing with somebody on Twitter the other day about how I was traumatized as a boy, probably 10, 11 years old, when they showed that movie, A Thief in the Night, when I was in church, you know, and it was, everybody had to watch it. That movie utterly terrified me as a young man, a young boy, really. And they were thinking they're doing it all for the right reasons. You know, they want to make sure that we end up getting into heaven, I guess. But I was so terrified, like you said, of not knowing, had I committed the unpardonable sin? Had I done something that God was going to kick me out? And when the rapture occurred, I was going to miss it and I'd be left behind. Man, I probably prayed the sinner's prayer thousands and thousands of times, just agonizing over whether or not I was really a Christian, because I sure didn't want to miss the rapture. You know, and a lot of people have had that rapture trauma. In fact, that's even a hashtag on Twitter, that it's become a thing that so many people have identified with when they grew up like me and you. You're just utterly terrified. And I mean, the trauma that does to a kid, it's just unbelievable.
Yes, it really is unbelievable. And when we look at some of these doctrines, I think it's amazing just how terrifying and really pernicious they are. I mean, the book of Revelation, I like to call it God's final solution for humankind. Jesus' second coming is like the final solution. He comes in with weapons of mass destructions, destroys the entire planet with a series of plagues, and wipes out 90% of humanity. And we're supposed to look forward to this as some kind of day of salvation. And it's really, this apocalypse is this invasion of mass destruction by God. And that is absolutely terrifying for young children. And so is the idea that you could be possessed by a demon, or I call them spirit monsters.
Yeah.
Just for having bad thoughts, or for listening to secular music, or for, God forbid, masturbating, touching yourselves, or smoking marijuana, something like that.
Some horrible sin. Well, thinking about it, just the other day, Franklin Graham, in the context of Donald Trump kicking off about how he was recorded by his lawyer talking about his affairs, Franklin Graham tweeted out, he said, "Remember, everybody, God always records every thought, every action, every deed that we have all of our lives. You know, so at the final judgment, that's all going to be replayed for us." Talk about terrifying. I mean, like you're saying, thinking about this God up there recording every thought, every action, everything we do in secret. And someday that's going to be used against us, apparently. So salvation actually isn't good news, really, if you're saved, but then you're always worried about losing your salvation. That's surely not good news, is it?
Yeah, it's a hoax. And this thing that's called grace is really kind of like a snake oil. It's designed to sell us into a traumatic system. Because really, the religion creates the problem. And if you don't buy into the problem, you don't need it. It's a predatory system, and evangelism is predatory. The first task of evangelism is to convince people that they have a problem. And
yeah, they're going to hell.
It exploits the weaknesses and vulnerability of some of our most needy populations. For instance, take the issue of drug addiction. You know, these people are in a vulnerable state. And so it's easy to tell people who are in addiction, you're basically bad, you're diseased, you need to be saved. And this is how you do it.
And they would certainly believe it, because if they've hit rock bottom, too.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah,
they're in like you say, they're in a vulnerable state already. As AA says, our lives have become unmanageable. So we're reaching for that higher power, you know? So you've got them convinced that you know exactly who that higher power is.
Yeah. And I think that outsourcing your power is no way to reclaim your power. That it's fundamentally disempowering to believe that the way to achieve liberation or healing is to entrust your decision making and your entire life and soul to an outside authority, such as the Bible or religious teachers, and that ultimately leads to further distress and suffering.
Well, of course, though, this is the thing I've been thinking about a lot lately, is that evangelicals or conservatives, fundamentalists, they are convinced that they have an inspired, inerrant, error-free Bible, so therefore that gives them extra authority, doesn't it, to believe that they are right in what they're talking about. So that's why they're pulling verses out about people that are going to hell. And then, like you say, you've got to give them the bad news first, then give them the good news that there's a way out of this horrible situation that you're facing. Jesus died on the cross and you can get out of going to hell. But it turns out it's not actually that good of news, is it? If you're constantly worried about losing your salvation or making God angry, getting judged for something you've done.
Yes. And I like to take a common sense morality approach to this. I like to tell people to trust their moral instincts and to kind of get really simple about the issues that we're facing. Because I think that people who defend these ideas can kind of try to pull us away into these abstractions and these philosophical ideas of trying to define love and evil and say, well, how do you know what love is or what justice is, and get really abstract about it. But I like to say, you know, most children know that genocide and torture or human sacrifice are wrong. Most people don't need to be told that burning someone with fire is not healthy.
No.
It doesn't result in moral living. It takes the ingenuity and genius of a theologian to explain to people that hellfire is the way to go. But just the innate moral wisdom of a child and the common sense to know that this is not healthy. This is not the way forward for humanity. If the ideas that we encountered in the Bible or in a certain religion were in any other book, if you encountered them in any other place, would you support that idea or would you oppose it? I think we've tended to sanctify certain ideologies just because people hold them to be sacred, just because they're found in religious texts. And I think that ideas are ideas, and bad ideas always have bad consequences, and we need to be able to look at these ideas objectively.
Are you more interested in saying that it's the fault of the Bible itself or what people have done with the Bible? I mean, I'm not saying it's a binary opposition, but it seems like part of the problem is what you're saying the Bible itself teaches, but certainly we can point to many, many examples historically where people have abused biblical teachings, like, for example, to justify slavery or the Spanish Inquisition. You know, there's been terrible times when the church was part of oppressing people and torturing and killing people in the name of God.
Yes. Well, I think the problem is that people have taken the Bible literally. Not that they've distorted it for their own maniacal end. And really, a lot of what the Bible says is easy to interpret. A lot of it is very plain and simple and basic. And so I think the fault often lies in the fact that people take the Bible literally, that they're very serious about it, that they have good intentions. And there are some amazingly twisted and frankly fascist ideologies in the Bible that people have taken literally throughout history, such as genocide. For instance, there's an entire book of the Bible, the book of Joshua, that's written in the genre of ethnic cleansing propaganda. The purpose of the book was for the Israelites to maintain their religion, the purity of their religion, by wiping out foreigners among them who followed other religions. Literally, it was an ethnic cleansing narrative.
Yeah.
So people have taken this literally throughout history to endorse genocide, or there's commands to slavery in scripture, or they're just threatening people with divine judgment or hellfire. A lot of these teachings are very apparent. The idea of sin, original sin, I think is maybe the most destructive teaching in the whole Bible. The idea that our fundamental nature is evil, that we can't trust ourselves, that our basic inclination is evil and we deserve punishment just for being born. That's a radically extreme idea. So for me, in my personal experience, I had also tried to moderate my religion. When I started having these questions, I said, you know, the problem is with me and my lack of faith, because that's what the religious system does. It has all these mechanisms for keeping people in the system, like any cult or cultish ideology. So I blamed myself, and I tried out more liberal and more progressive versions of Christianity. But what I kept coming back to was the fact that some of the most pernicious ideas were written plainly in the Bible, and I couldn't get around the Bible and the scriptures.
That becomes an existential problem, doesn't it? I think I've come to a very similar place, because I've wrestled a lot with those texts about in Joshua, where God commands genocide, and some of the other problematic texts. And I've come back and I've said, now, wait a minute. There's been a lot of explanations, you know, theodicy and all this other stuff to justify the actions of God and so forth. But if you're taking the Bible literally, which a good conservative Christian kind of has to, because they believe the Bible's inspired and inerrant and everything else, then they have to reconcile the fact that God, the text says, God commanded his people to wipe out a whole people group, as you said. What do you do with that kind of a God? That's a serious, serious problem. You can't get around it.
Yes, and this all makes sense if we take seriously the history of how these books were constructed and where these ideas came from. I mean, the biblical God, who is known as Yahweh, was a war deity. He was a war deity who emerged out of a polytheistic framework back when Israel used to believe in many gods. And this idea of a god called Yahweh, he was modeled after really dictators, after a dictator king who controlled his population by inspiring fear. I mean, the Bible says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Well, in my opinion, fear is not a good way to, is not a foundation for wisdom.
Right. It's not a good place from which to
start. Accepting reality
as
it is a foundation for wisdom. But yeah. This war deity, his actions kind of follow suit from his character. And really, just looking at this deity, in a lot of ways, he's worse than any devil. I mean, he's some serious Dr. Evil. His idea of justice is commanding obedience, commanding worship. He's an egotist who believes in domination, and that he created the world in order to torture eternally the vast majority of humanity based on whether they answer a divine quiz correctly, namely, who is God?
Yeah, if you're a good Calvinist, it's the only people that are going to enter into heaven are those who have been actually pre-selected by that God, and they were elect, and the rest of them are not going to make it in, and there's nothing they can do to get into heaven. And that's God's choice. And they'll say, well, the people should be happy that God even chose any. We're all justly condemned to hell. So we actually should be grateful that even a small fraction of humanity is going to enter into heaven. I mean, that's the kind of answer that you get to questions like that, don't you?
Yeah, and I'd like to talk a little bit about hell.
Okay.
Because I feel a moral obligation to oppose the teaching of hell. Hell is really a form of psychological terrorism. 58% of Americans, according to a 2014 Pew study, believe in hell. Hell is the most sadistic idea possible. That's the whole point of it. The whole point of the idea of hell is that it's the worst fear possibly imaginable. There's no worse idea than hell.
Yeah.
And we know how this idea came about. At least in the Judeo-Christian worldview, hell was imagined by people who were being oppressed by civilization, the Israelites, in the period of writing between the Old and New Testaments, known as the Intertestamental Period. They suffered massive oppression under different empires and massive injustices. A lot of their infants were at times being slaughtered before their eyes. Really horrible, horrible things. So they didn't see justice in their own lifetime, and they asked the question, well, how can God be just if all we're seeing is injustice and God is not rescuing us? So they said, well, God's going to pay these people back, not in our own lifetime, but in the next lifetime. And they imagined the worst possible punishment upon their enemies. It was really a system of revenge, because that's what they thought they deserved. So that's kind of how this idea of hell, of eternal torture, came about. I just think it's an incredibly oppressive ideology. If you subscribe to hell, really you're committing blasphemy, because God is responsible for the worst evil imaginable. And you're ascribing diabolical evil to God.
That's what the stock answer, isn't it? Is that I just saw a meme on Instagram today that said, and I said this to people when I was an evangelical, that God's not sending you to hell. You're sending yourself there by not believing in him. Have you heard that one? We've heard variations of that same theme, haven't we? That, you know, God doesn't send anyone to hell. People choose to go there by not accepting his free will of salvation and free, you know, free offer of grace and all that. So it's a great, makes a great comeback for sure. It made a great meme on Instagram for somebody.
Yeah. And that's absolutely ridiculous because no human being would ever choose their worst possible suffering. I mean, come on. That's just that's just some kind of apologetic theological mumbo jumbo that you only would ever make that argument if you were forced to believe in the idea of hell. Because if you believe in inspiration of the Bible, you're forced to defend all kinds of indefensible doctrines.
That's
because
the whole idea of dogma
is that it's true because it's true. It's true because the Bible says so. It's true because this idea of divine authority. And really, I think this gets to the root of the problem, which is religious faith. I think that dogmatism and the idea of religious faith is actually the root of all bad ideas.
And religionism.
It's religious faith.
Yeah.
The religious idea of faith, which is that we are to believe in something because of someone else's authority. So it's accepting an idea based on faith without reference to evidence. So there may be evidence for an idea, but there may also not be. And the evidence is kind of coincidental. What really matters is the authority. And it's kind of this blind allegiance to authority. And that's how you get people defending ideas like hell or saying that the earth is 6,000 years old and that evolution isn't true. We know that these things aren't true, but people are forced to believe it because of this whole idea of dogma and of faith, and a world of error results. You have to defend these things that don't make any intellectual sense. You get smart people and moral people defending immoral, unintelligible ideas.
It strikes me that when you were talking about hell, I don't know if you read Rob Bell's book, Love Wins, but when that came out, I don't know if you remember when that came out. It must have been about 10 or 12 years ago, maybe more, but it caused a huge firestorm. And I remember reading it at the time and thinking, you know, this is pretty cool because what Rob Bell is able to do in the book is he goes through and marshals a whole bunch of biblical evidence as he reads the Bible to quote unquote prove that basically the Bible doesn't teach this eternal conscious torment in hell, but actually it's kind of this universalist message. And I think a lot of the thing about the book is that it's a huge relief for people who want to stay Christian but still believe in the Bible and everything else. And I think a lot of people breathed a sigh of relief and said, oh, thank God, you know, Rob Bell, you've saved us because we can believe that there's no such thing as hell, but we can still stay Christians and, you know, keep all the good stuff that we want to retain from our evangelical faith. But yet I look at it now and I think it's just one more person arguing for his particular interpretation of the Bible that just happens to believe that it doesn't teach a literal fiery eternal conscious torment in hell. I don't know. What do you think of his argument? I don't know if have you read it, any of his stuff on that?
I have not read it, but I've heard different variations of that kind of an argument. And I also hear a lot of people backing away from the idea of a literal hell now, just because of how obviously atrocious it is, just how evil an idea it really is. And some people will say that hell is a metaphor, and they'll try to get metaphorical and say that people choose their own hell, or that hell is just an idea of people choosing to be separate from God, and hell is a natural result of separation from God forever. And what I like to say is that metaphors endorse the symbols they utilize.
Right.
So a metaphor of hell is still endorsing eternal torture. It's still endorsing this kind of eternal concentration camp that God sets up. Or even if it's psychological torture, it's still torture. It's always problematic to endorse a negative metaphor to teach a point. And you have to do this when you hold the Bible as the literal word of God, because there are so many teachings. I mean, really, human sacrifice is at the heart of this religion. Throughout Israel's history, God makes blood pacts, blood covenants with his people. He demands animal sacrifice, and this ultimately culminates in the human sacrifice of Jesus, which is supposed to cover up our sins or make atonement for our sins, or however you interpret that, however fancy you get with your metaphor, you end up endorsing a really twisted symbol of human sacrifice. It's kind of like trying to make a metaphor out of rape to make a moral lesson. It doesn't work. I don't care what you do with that metaphor. You're still endorsing a symbol that is problematic.
Yeah, that's a good point, because so many people have pointed out that it's God who set up the whole rules of this game. If you look at it that way, as you're describing it, he's the one who laid out the problem that we're all sinners, apparently, and we need something. As soon as Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden, that's when the problem all started, wasn't it? And then he set up the solution of the law, the sacrificial system, and as you say, culminates in the ultimate and greatest sacrifice in Jesus, because that's what basically the book of Hebrews is arguing all about, isn't it? Jesus is the last and final sacrifice, and we no longer need anything after that. So all of our problems are solved if you buy that whole rules of the game. But if you don't, you're kind of screwed, aren't you? Where does that leave you?
You are definitely screwed.
Yeah, I remember a friend of mine years ago when I was an evangelical, how staunchly I actually defended the doctrine of hell. And why do evangelicals so staunchly defend it? This guy came to me, this was when I was in a church up in Seattle, and he said, "Hey, I've discovered a brand new reading of the Bible. There is no such thing as hell, the literal, you know, hell. People are just going to be cast into the outer darkness. That's what the Bible says." And I remember having these massive arguments with him on the phone for hours and hours about how he was wrong. And there is such thing as hell, and you're reading the Bible wrong. There is no such thing as the outer darkness. And we'd go back and forth and back and forth. I mean, why was I so passionately defending this horrible, hideous doctrine?
The reality is that both arguments are true in certain ways.
Yeah.
Because the Bible teaches all kinds of different things.
Exactly.
Because it was written by different authors over millennia, who held different positions and had different ideas. And if you look at it as this one unified, divinely inspired text, you have to believe in some of the texts and mute the voices of other texts, or just plainly deny them because of these contradictions, which really aren't contradictions, by the way. They're just different viewpoints and different ideas by different people, or sometimes people contradicting themselves. I mean, the Bible doesn't read like what we would expect it to be if it was a divinely inspired, perfect text. If we have all these problems that contradict science, or that are grossly immoral, or that reflect power dynamics and authoritarianism, because they were, I mean, and the easiest solution to this problem is that they were written by people.
Exactly. Well, but there's been volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes written by theologians and biblical scholars alike that have tried to clear up all these sort of discrepancies. They wouldn't see them as contradictions, but man, there's always an answer for everything you just said. There's an answer out there, isn't there? As to, no, it's not a problem. Yes, we can reconcile all these seemingly discrepant texts and all this. There's a lot of people who have spent their living forcing these things to harmonize. Well, look at the Gospels. I mean, forcing the harmonization of four Gospels, that each of which has sort of different viewpoints and different kind of storylines and different information in it. And yet there's people who he'll say there's no problem. There's no contradiction. Everything fits somehow. There's no cognitive dissonance here.
Yes, precisely. And I think we find people devoting their lives to defending these kinds of ideas because really of the psychological impact of religion. And I guess I can get back to my story here. I think that religion ends up being a total identity system for a lot of people. And when our beliefs about our identity and our way of finding purpose and meaning and community in our lives are threatened, we feel as if our survival is threatened. That's the psychological impact of a religious belief, is it's so tightly wound up in the way we view ourselves and really how we make all of our decisions that it's kind of seen as a survival necessity. And I mean, you had this experience of what we call a crisis of faith. It's really traumatic to have to question your basic beliefs about the nature of reality and your purpose in the world.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a really scary thing.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of compassion for people who are going through this kind of questioning. It's a really tough and challenging process. And I like to call it a total identity system, fundamentalism, because it commands us to really give our entire lives, our souls, our spirits, everything to this deity, to this religious system. And when that's called into question, we can be thrown into a state of psychological crisis, of existential crisis. And that's why I think it's important for therapists and people to be trained in helping people to recover from religious trauma or to go through spiritual transitions, because a lot of this is happening in the world. I think there are millions of people today who are asking these kinds of questions because it's harder and harder to be isolated within a religious system or to maintain a religious identity, because it's not like thousands of years ago when people didn't have the internet and they just listened to what they were told. We're bombarded with information. We're constantly meeting people with other religions. And so there's a lot of this going on right now, but there's not a lot of attention being drawn to the psychological abuses or solutions being given to how we can actually heal and address these issues.
Well, and you talk about the trauma of having that crisis of faith. I was just doing a podcast recording with Chris Stroop the other night, which is going to be coming out around the end of August, early September. And he was describing his own personal crisis of faith, which started off with intellectual problems. And he went and saw this mentor guy who, I don't want to take too much away from Chris's story, but he went to a minister friend who helped him for a while, but then this minister was kind of running out of answers, and he basically turned around and said to Chris, well, the problem with your whole crisis of faith is I've answered all your questions and you're still having doubts, so the problem must be that you have probably some unconfessed sin in your life. That's the problem. That's why you're having this crisis of faith. So then he went away and was racking his brains and said, you know, what have I done? What's this sin in my life that I'm having these doubts? So, I mean, it's a no-win scenario, isn't it? Unbelievable.
Yes, it can be very oppressive. One of my passions is to help people experience authentic spirituality. And for me, that means a prerequisite for spirituality is freedom for personal development. And I like to say no human being can fully shine within a religious system because there's so much fear and so many mechanisms of control. I mean, this whole idea of sin and blaming doubt on the person and telling people that they're bad. And so I think that in general, religion is, or dogmatic religion, it's unhealthy for people. And I think that for us to prosper and for us to grow, we need to draw attention to these abuses.
Which is what you're doing, isn't it, with your writing as well as your workshop. In fact, maybe you could kind of get into that for a little bit. You're doing a workshop on the 14th of August. Is it in the San Francisco area? It's where you're living now, pretty much,
yeah.
Isn't it? So can you talk us through what are you covering in this workshop that you're doing? And how does it tie in with your passion for sort of underscoring the psychological and traumatic issues around religion?
So the workshop is called Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion, and it's August 14th. It's in Oakland on a Tuesday evening. And sexuality is a favorite issue of religion. Religion loves to harp on this issue, and it tends to create a lot of shame around the issue of sexuality. People are shamed just for being sexual. And many of us were taught that our basic sexual instincts were evil and had to be repressed or confessed or entirely done away with. This comes from Jesus on his Sermon on the Mount. He tells us that if you lust after a woman in your heart, if you even think a sexual thought or have a desire, you're in danger of the fires of hell. So we're given this association of sex with being burned with fire forever. And there's a lot of LGBTQ issues. There's a lot of preaching against gays. I mean, in our country, gay marriage was illegal until recently, and a lot of gay people have committed suicide because they're told by religion that their homosexuality is evil. So there are all sorts of issues of sexual repression and oppression related to religion, and really our culture is religious. So even if you didn't grow up within a religion, you've been impacted by religious ideas around sexuality. So we're going to discuss these ideas. We're going to do an overview of what the ideas are so we can understand, first of all, well, what happened? What are the issues that affect me? And then how do we get better? How do we reclaim sexuality as something spiritual and sacred and healing and life-giving, which I think is really the ultimate way we should understand sexuality.
And of course, you talk about the evangelical purity culture stuff, your issues of sexuality, man. I mean, there's so many young people that grew up in that system and are now currently growing up in that system. They are so messed up psychologically, sexually, from having to, like you say, suppress their sexuality. And, you know, they're experimenting with all kinds of other stuff and getting into all kinds of trouble just to try to remain virginal. So they're doing anal sex and other things, but hey, technically I'm still a virgin, you know, so it's unbelievable what's going on within that culture, isn't it?
Yeah, not only is that immoral, this whole idea of sexual immorality, I would say is actually as sexually immoral as it gets to tell people that sexuality is evil. That's sexual immorality.
Right.
To call someone's purest and one of our purest and basic animal drives evil, that's not purity. But religion often does this. It often flips the script on what morality is and defines it by its opposite, interestingly enough. So yeah, you have celibacy and abstinence propounded as if it's a healthy thing. I mean, look at the virgin birth.
Exactly.
And look at church leadership throughout the centuries.
Celibate monks.
How celibacy has been endorsed as this spiritual path.
Exactly.
So there are all these things, and this is one of the main reasons people end up leaving religion too, realizing the sexual harm that they've experienced. So I guess back to my story a little bit.
Yeah.
I had suffered with this tremendous fear of hell. I had confessed the sinner's prayer sometimes thousands of times a day, because I was shown these violent images of hellfire torture in church and told that if I wasn't right with God, I could die and end up in hell. And so I was doing that, and I ended up getting really kind of OCD in my mind and full of anxiety. And the sexual oppression, I saw sex as a curse from God. And I prayed for God to take away my sexual desire, because it was only a source of temptation. It was only a source of struggle in my life. So when I started having sex, I experienced disassociation from my body. I had all kinds of performance anxiety and sexual dysfunction, because that kind of trauma, that kind of sexual abuse, it doesn't just go away overnight. You know, I mean, we're talking about years of abuse through indoctrination.
Oh yeah.
And
it's deep in there for sure.
So all of this, very, very deep. It goes really to the core of our identity.
Yeah.
And calling sex sinful, or calling our basic human nature evil and wicked and deserving of divine wrath.
It's interesting, because I was just reading an article the other day, this scandal that's just erupted with the Cardinal of Washington, D.C. I don't know if you saw that, but he's been removed from his post finally after decades of rumors that he was abusing boys and all the rest of it. Classic story of the Catholic Church, you know, pedophile priests and everything. But this article was saying that you got this system, as you say, that says celibacy is the ideal. You take a young Catholic boy who might be, let's say, struggling with feelings of homosexuality, and he says to himself, well, this is evil, this is wrong, it's against the Bible, it's against God. So what I'll do is I'll become a priest, and I'll suppress that side of me, and God will help me to do that. What better place to be than a priest? And so is it any wonder that these things are coming out and have come out for years and years and years? When you enter into that kind of system, and accepting the rules of that system, suppressing and telling yourself that these desires are evil and sick and immoral and God is against it and he's going to send you to hell for it.
Yes, exactly. So sexual energy is so basic and foundational, not only to humanity, but really to the entire universe. I mean, ultimately, everything is sexual. The cosmos, planets and stars have bodies and they reproduce in a manner of speaking. Interestingly, the Milky Way galaxy is on a collision course with the Andromeda galaxy. And in about 4 billion years, they're going to collide. And when they do, tons of new stars are going to be birthed. So in a way, galaxies have sex and plants have sex and animals have sex. So it's such a basic foundational force. It can almost be described as a God force. It's this powerful creative energy. You can't suppress that energy. And when you try to suppress it, it'll find expression exactly. In other ways. And it does.
It will come out somewhere.
That within religion, people still behave the same way sexually. They just tend to deny it. They tend to live in dishonesty or tend to feel really guilty about it.
Oh, yeah. Feel terrible about it.
But manipulating sexuality is an effective way of getting people to obey a system, especially when you threaten people with it, because they're going to keep coming back to you for forgiveness or for the solution to the method to suppressing their sexuality.
Exactly.
And sometimes this can be redirected in extreme ways, like extreme devotion to a deity or celibate service to the religion or to God. And that might sometimes, the root of that might just be an attempt to redirect one's sexual energy. So yeah, this results in actual physical sexual abuse too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Pedophilia and all kinds of immorality. But I like to call attention to the psychological abuse because I think that's the primary thing that this unseen epidemic that is happening in our world.
So that's your kind of platform. Where's a good place for people to get a hold of you? Obviously, they can come to your seminar, but if they can't make this one coming up in Oakland next week, what's the best way to get a hold of you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook? What? And can you give us again the name of your blog?
Absolutely. So my name is Andrew Jasko, and my blog is lifeafterdogma.org. I blog a lot. I love to do interviews and speaking engagement, and I also do coaching for religious trauma recovery and spiritual transitions. I don't tell anyone that they should leave their religion, but there are a lot of people in crisis who are suffering from abuse. And I like to say that a lot of times religion or religious systems can look like an abusive relationship. That is, people are getting their needs met within religion, and religion does a lot of good. Religious people generally are great people, and they're doing a lot of good things. But the problem is that there's abuse being mixed in there, that there's fear is used as a motivation for this good. And that's a confusing mixture. It's important for us to recognize that abuse and work with it, and sometimes to step out of the environment where the abuse is going on so we can gain a clearer perspective and then decide, do I want to move forward with this religion or choose a different version of it or look at other religions. And those are all options that can be explored. So you can find my contact information at lifeafterdogma.org or add me on Facebook and get bombarded by all my writing.
Well, I really appreciate your approach to the whole thing, because it struck me as quite a unique one, because you got your classic atheists and all that who argue from the intellectual point of view, like you were talking about earlier, against, you know, the existence of God or the problems within the Bible or whatever you want to come at it from an intellectual, biblical, theological, scholarly point of view. But I like the fact that you're coming at it and saying, hey, there's millions of people, really, isn't there, out there who have suffered psychological, emotional, sexual trauma and damage within religion. And it's not just confined to Christianity, for sure, is it? But you're trying to help people come to grips with all that stuff that they've experienced. Are you trying to work against the system at all, or are you more interested in helping people who have been damaged by it?
Well, I guess kind of both and.
Right.
Abuse is abuse, and I think we need to call it abuse. And if that requires slaughtering some holy cows,
So be it.
And that's what needs to happen.
That's what has to happen. You have to deconstruct
it. But I mean, I'm not primarily motivated by an antagonistic desire or a desire to tear things down. I'm motivated by seeing people live in their authentic power, by seeing people free and experience a spirituality that's more fantastically mind-blowing and amazing and miraculous than anything that I'd ever encountered within religion. And I really believe that that's possible within whatever framework you decide to move forward with, whether it's atheism or some other kind of belief system. But that the root of it comes from love, and that fear is not a good way to motivate moral living or disempowering or outsourcing your moral authority and ability to some kind of blind allegiance to something else.
I like how you say that. It's disempowering ultimately, isn't it? At the end of the day, we're giving away that power to someone, something else. And so, yeah, where does that leave the person? I will say that fear is a great way to control and motivate other people, though. It works, man. It's worked for millennia in all kinds of religions, hasn't it? It's a great way to control people, but it's so unhealthy.
Exactly.
Well, listen, this has been great. I don't want to keep you too long. I'm super appreciative of this hour or so that you've spent with us. I hope that people can come out to your seminar or your workshop on the 14th. And if not, they can maybe read some of your writings, get in touch with you, and get some help, especially if you're the kind of person that Andrew's been describing, someone who was raised within the system, has been traumatized and damaged emotionally, psychologically, sexually, whatever it might be. So thank you so much, Andrew, for taking the time out of your busy schedule and giving us a chance to talk.
It's been a pleasure, Clint.
As we mentioned in this episode, and I think as well in the introduction, Andrew is doing a seminar in the Oakland area called Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion on the 14th of August. And the links to that are in the show notes if you're in that area, the San Francisco, Oakland area. And there's actually really good news too. If you cannot physically make it to the event, it is going to be live streamed on Eventbrite for those who purchase tickets. So again, look in the show notes for the contact information about how you can at least watch it live on Eventbrite. And I wanted to share with you, too, one last thought from Andrew. He has a Facebook page that talks about his Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion seminar, as well as some of the stuff he writes. And he says, quote, writing the presentation for Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion, this is the workshop he's going to be doing on the 14th, he says, has been an emotional experience. Going through the issues systematically, I am a witness to much human suffering, including my own. Looking at the facts, I am amazed. It's often deeper and darker than I had thought. Yet I am also overjoyed at the profound mystery and power of sexuality. Healing comes through understanding what happened and how it continues to play a role in our lives. We must behold and embrace our suffering self. We must embrace the corporate suffering self, humanity's past wounds. We are all participants. There is a sexual revolution taking place, he says. It involves healing and moving beyond healing, understanding that sexuality is a powerful source of love, life, and human achievement. Come join me as we explore reclaiming sexuality from religion. So if that sounds interesting to you and something you want to explore, at least you can follow it, as I say, live streaming on Eventbrite if you purchase tickets. So one of the things I wanted to mention too before I let you go was that next week I'm bringing you part one of Growing Up Evangelical, You Can't Make This Shit Up, with my buddy Jeff Judd. We sat down while I was in Seattle recently and recorded a couple of podcast episodes talking about crazy, insane stories of growing up evangelical in a Christian fundamentalist high school. And the stories are astounding and unbelievable. They are hilariously funny, but in a way, we're kind of laughing through the tears. So be sure and come back next Friday for part one of my conversation with Jeff Judd. I guarantee it'll make you laugh, maybe even make you cry a little bit. So I'll see you next Friday right here on Mindshift Podcast.